Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, a reminder that KABU is in the midst of our fall pledge drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Help us reach our $55,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Northwest Natural Gas and other frack gas utilities are spending massive amounts of money on a campaign to promote so-called natural gas as a sustainable and carbon-free fuel for the future. But a recent report titled Methane Gas, Health, Safety, and Decarbonization tells a different story of just how dangerous and deadly methane gas really is. Supported by 64 organizations from around the Pacific Northwest, the report is intended to curtail confusion created by Northwest Natural and other fossil fuel entities' purposeful misinformation campaigns targeting elected officials and the public. Today we talk with two people involved in researching and writing this report. Danine O'Rourke is the campaign manager with 350PDX, and Dylan Plummer is a senior campaign representative with the Sierra Club. Denise and Dylan, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having us, Barbara.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, I want to start by reading this letter, or part of it, that I got from Northwest Natural a few weeks ago. I'm assuming you've gotten the same letter if you're customers of Northwest Natural, as have probably many of our listeners. But the letter starts, "Dear valued customer, today's energy landscape has become increasingly complex and there are critical decisions on the horizon, including some that impact you as a customer of Northwest Natural. We are engaged in a number of fronts to reduce carbon emissions, improve energy efficiency, and transition more of our supply to renewable energy. Our low-carbon pathway strategy introduces renewable energy for the pipeline with affordability, dependability, and resilience in mind. At the same time, we are monitoring Oregon Governor Kate Brown's executive order to reduce carbon emissions, which is being designed now by state agencies, as well as monitoring proposals from some groups for bans of new natural gas hookups." So let's talk a little bit about what Northwest Natural is up to, why they're sending these letters out, why I saw a giant billboard somewhere on the road in Portland the other day. I think they have bus ads, and we get constant emails. What is Northwest Natural up to?
Yeah, maybe I could just quickly start off by saying Northwest Natural is spending a massive amount of money right now to convince Oregon and folks within its distribution area that it is not a fossil fuel corporation and does not need to be regulated as we move towards a just transition off of fossil fuels. So I think that's kind of like the basis of everything that they're doing, everything that they're writing to you in the mail, that everything that they're saying on these billboards.
Well, they actually have to have 4 points on this letter. The first one is all forms of renewable energy are needed in a balanced low carbon future. So they start talking about renewable natural gas, which we're going to talk about, as well as clean hydrogen. And also they have a vision of a carbon neutral pipeline by 2050. So we want to get into what that is. Then they also say that families and businesses should have a choice of energy options to meet their needs. Communities with natural gas have greater energy reliability. And of course, last winter when we were without power for 3 days, I was very happy that we had a gas furnace, a gas stove, a gas radiant heater. But I also felt kind of a little bit of a hypocrite being so comfortable with those things. And then the last thing they say is affordability and leveraging our existing modern system is our priority. So let's take those one by one. First of all, is there any truth to the fact that Northwest Natural Gas is providing renewable energy forms?
Yeah, this is a really, really sophisticated marketing campaign they've been doing for a while now called Less We Can. And, you know, in it, you'll see a lot of like these billboards and this letter and commercials of like happy families cooking together in the kitchen and walking through a beautiful field and an attractive couple cozied up next to a gas fireplace. And it all just like makes you feel really warm and fuzzy inside. But it's really just propaganda. And this whole, like, reading this letter to me really just sounds like a company that really sees the writing on the wall and is desperately trying to stay relevant. In this letter, when they say renewable energy for the pipeline, this is their branding of renewable natural gas, this double greenwashed idea, which is about producing methane from the digestion of organic materials from landfills, sewage sludge, farms, And then that methane is captured and put into our pipeline system to be used theoretically in place of fracked gas.
What's the reality of that, though, Dylan?
Yeah, so the reality of it is that studies, even from our state agency, the Oregon Department of Energy, have shown that the availability of renewable natural gas is just a fraction of the current demand for gas. And there's also a ton of concerns around environmental justice impacts, because renewable natural gas, first of all, it's just recycled emissions. Those are emissions that will still go into the atmosphere. They're just reusing them once before they go. And second, they're coming from generally what are considered environmental bads, things that are just inherently bad for our community and for our environment, such as CAFOs, that's concentrated animal feeding lots or feeding operations, and landfills. And so, you know, this idea that, you know, not only do we need to get more renewable natural gas, but we need to generate more sources of renewable natural gas translates to a lot of folks as we need to build more CAFOs in your backyard. We need to build more landfills. And of course, those environmental projects, or those environmentally impacting projects or impactful projects, generally and disproportionately impact low-income communities, Black, Indigenous, people of color communities, and communities that are already experiencing disproportionate environmental harms.
Well, a number of years ago, I got into an argument with a friend of mine in California who's a lawyer for the University of California. And he was talking about how they were investing in all these methane digesters for CAFOs in the Central Valley of California. And he was talking about how that was really a good deal for the environment. And at the time, I knew a little bit about methane digestion, and I had only heard it being successful on very small scales. There's a organic farm down in Philomath that I'd seen it being used, and it seemed to work. And also, I know that they're using it, they have been using it for quite a while in Tillamook, in the real Tillamook dairy land in Tillamook, Oregon, as opposed to that other Tillamook dairy at Three Mile Canyon in the Gorge, which is basically a giant CAFO. And what I was suggesting to him was that it works on small scales. It really has never been proven to work on a large scale. So I wonder if my theory of 5 or 6 years ago is actually accurate.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what this, I mean, there's reports looking nationally. And there's also, like I mentioned, this state report from the Oregon Department of Energy that shows that RNG, in a best case scenario in which technologies that aren't currently scaled are brought up to, you know, kind of their peak scale, it can provide less than 1/5 of Oregon's current demand for natural gas. And it doesn't mention the fact that there are environmental implications, like I just mentioned, as well as the many health concerns that we have about natural gas are not mitigated when you burn RNG. So, you know, even in a perfect world where they were able to get 100% of the current demand from renewable natural gas, and they were able to do so in a way that maintained relatively low rates for customers, there would still be this massive problem of huge impacts to indoor and outdoor air quality from combusting methane in these gas appliances.
Now, another topic that I'd like to get on to that Northwest Natural Gas is touting is this idea of clean or green hydrogen. What is that?
Yeah, so I can speak to that. So green hydrogen isn't inherently bad in theory. Green hydrogen is the idea that you can take renewable energy. Oftentimes it's discussed as like taking excess renewable energy. Maybe that's on an extremely windy day when there's more energy than can be channeled into the grid that's being generated. You take that excess energy and you use it to generate hydrogen by splitting water molecules. So it's a pretty costly method of energy generation, but it creates hydrogen, which is like a shelf stable and can be potentially made with 100% renewable energy. So that sounds nice, right? It's like a potential alternative to batteries. But when we hear about green hydrogen discussed in the context of these gas industries and their PR campaigns, what they're talking about is using that green hydrogen directly in their pipelines and in gas appliances, which is just an absolute fallacy. That it's not possible. What science tells us is that current gas infrastructure can only use a mixture of gas and hydrogen, with green hydrogen levels reaching about 15%. So even if we wanted to, we couldn't put more than 15% of the gas in our pipelines to, like, that couldn't come from the green hydrogen. So put it another way, in a best case scenario, we still have 85% natural, quote unquote, natural fracked gas running through our pipes, and 15% of this extremely costly, energy inefficient green hydrogen. And again, there are still these massive health implications associated with burning any kind of gas in a home.
Right. It's really just a political strategy, just to continue allowing the expansion of the gas industry, and really just muddies the water on the main goal we're working towards of electrification.
Absolutely. I would just say really quickly, renewable natural gas and green hydrogen are serving as a red herring so that the gas industry can redirect attention away from solutions that work, i.e. electrification of everything we possibly can, to these incredibly expensive, inefficient, and unproven technologies that they can rate base to their customers and increase their share value on Wall Street.
Well, I want to get to two other points in that Northwest Natural Gas letter, which actually do resonate a little bit. And the first one is reliability. Now, I mentioned that during the power outage, during the ice storm last winter, we were without power for 3 days. And it was not that uncomfortable for us because we had gas. And I had many conversations with friends about how fortunate we were to have gas. At the same time, I've been working for a number of years now to try to get rid of gas, you know, as a main source of energy for everybody. So what do we do? I mean, if we have just electrification, what happens when there's a power outage? And how do we counter Northwest Natural's propaganda that, see, that power outage last winter shows that we need to have gas as an alternative to electricity?
Yeah, so I guess I can speak to that, which is, first of all, the idea that natural gas is a more, you know, resilient energy source is a complete lie, because, you know, in the face of many natural disasters, it's usually the gas infrastructure that's exploding or leaking noxious fumes. You know, we've seen multiple instances of buildings being evacuated here where I'm based in Eugene. In Portland, there was a massive explosion in 2018 that actually leveled buildings. Thankfully, no one was hurt. So this, just on its face, it's just a blatant lie that this infrastructure is more resilient in the face of some of the climate disasters that we expect in the future. And they're absolutely right, though, when they say that we need to be building in resiliency. And so when we talk about like a Green New Deal or a just transition, a big investment that our communities need to make is building in backups, energy storage, decentralized solar, and means by which to create a more resilient electric energy system. Because to burn fossil fuels as a solution to the potential impacts of climate disasters on our community is just absolutely a backwards concept, and one that's further endangering our community, not protecting us. And also, I will say, you know, during those blackouts last year, a lot of folks I talked to, you know, thought that they would be totally protected because they had, you know, gas appliances. But most gas appliances require an electric charge to use, turn on the pilot light. And so many gas appliances are rendered ineffective during electric blackouts. So, you know, there's a lot of flaws with their reasoning there. And it's really critical that, you know, as we are electrifying, we're making those really intentional investments on creating a power grid that can, you know, provide power, especially to necessary services, in the face of the climate kind of chaos that, you know, is already baked into our system.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Deneen O'Rourke and with 350 PDX and Dylan Plummer with the Sierra Club about the dire hazards of methane. Which gets me to another place, which is every time that I walk by our gas meter and look at that pipe, and there's a contraption on it that will supposedly turn it off if there's an earthquake. I think about the dangers of bringing this really inflammable substance into our house on a 24-hour basis. And I wanted to talk about those dangers and how Northwest Natural does not really address that.
First, I'll just add, when we were talking about extreme weather events too, I mean, we have to mention wildfires. And, you know, because of the very significant health impacts that burning methane inside has on indoor air quality, a lot of people recommend that, you know, it's clearly expensive and for many people cost prohibitive to just upgrade your stove. We definitely understand that. But ventilation, keeping your window open when you're using your gas stove can really help with those indoor air quality issues. But we can't do that when we are in smoke season and have the worst air quality in the world in parts of Oregon. And so how do we account for that? So there are other kinds of extreme weather events that we're experiencing in this region that, you know, having a gas stove is making that worse for us.
And I would add, too, that the Oregon Health Authority actually, in its recommendations around dealing with wildfire smoke, recommends that folks do not use gas appliances. So again, about resilience, you know, we're starting to experience wildfire smoke for months at a time in Southern Oregon. And the Oregon Health Authority, you know, our highest authority in the state around public health, is saying, well, just don't use your, you know, gas appliances while that's happening.
I wanted to get to one other thing that they point out is about affordability and really the great expense of transitioning from gas appliances to electric appliances. And I have been having conversations about getting rid of our gas stove, which is an aging stove, and at some point it's probably going to die. And at that point, I'm getting very interested in induction stoves, which I have some friends who have bought. And they're really, really expensive. And so I wonder, how is there an equitable way to get people who have gas appliances? And a lot of them, as the report mentions, are low-income people who live in apartments and actually have very faulty, probably leaky gas appliances. How do we get them to afford something like an induction stove?
It's a great question. I mean, there are many answers to this. I think in part, there's some like smaller mitigation pieces we can do to limit the health risks. You know, you can use an electric tea kettle instead of boiling water with a tea kettle on your stove. And just like the amount of like times where you can limit the use of a gas stove, the better. But in a larger sense, we do really need to make sure that renters and low-income homeowners are protected from costs that could be passed on as people like leave Northwest Natural and go towards electrification for their home. So we're really relying on like cities and counties need to take the lead on allocating resources for electrifying low-income households. And sharing information like we just shared about how to mitigate the effects of the health impacts.
I would just add too, there's with both the federal infrastructure package and the reconciliation package that are moving, there's a significant amount of money currently earmarked for subsidies for building electrification. And so there's going to be a potentially very exciting opportunity for these cities and counties to start directing those funds and programs to specifically target transitioning the most vulnerable communities off of gas first. And that's really just an absolute critical part of any kind of just transition off of fossil fuels, is ensuring that financial burden for the transition isn't placed on the communities with the least resources to pay for it.
Well, for someone like me who lives in a 115-year-old house, which interestingly, when we bought the house in 1993, we switched it off from electric and oil to gas because gas at the time seemed to be the cleanest source of energy. For us to now like put in an electric stove, and also we looked into putting in an electric water heater a couple years ago, and it was cost prohibitive and really invasive because it was going to do a major rewiring job. So how does that how do we find ways for people who live in older homes that want to make these changes actually be able to make them? Because it's a lot more complicated to rewire an old home for electric stove, electric heat pump, electric water heater than it is to wire a new place.
Absolutely. So I think that the first piece of it, right, is making sure that no new homes are being built on fossil fuels, right? So we don't have that problem. We can avoid any additional expenses that could be incurred from needing to retrofit, you know, however many years down the line when our policymakers finally really make a hard line that it's time to get off fossil fuels. It's absolutely imperative that we're making sure that all new buildings are built with electric so that they don't have to make this expensive transition down the line. And for taking on older buildings, you know, one thing I really think is exciting about this work is when we talk about doing retrofits on existing buildings for electrification, it opens up opportunities to talk about doing retrofits on existing buildings to increase energy efficiency, to increase climate resiliency, that's insulation, making homes fire-wise to be more resilient to wildfire, adding air conditioning units. And so, you know, it's obviously gonna have to be a monumental task and a significant investment from all levels of government, but it's critical that we're looking at the existing housing stock in Oregon and across the Pacific Northwest and across the country and figuring out not only how we can make those buildings fossil free, but also how we can make those buildings as resilient and as safe as possible, you know, with the knowledge that we are going to be experiencing changes in our climate and that, you know, folks deserve to be protected from that.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about this report that we mentioned at the top of the hour, that is looking at all the hazards of methane and why it's a very bad option and why there's such a pitch from the gas industry right now to promote itself as being a renewable fuel. So first of all, who was behind this report and who was responsible for writing it?
This report was released last month, and there are 64 organizations from around Oregon and Washington who support it. And the intention of this was to really consolidate all of the different research and findings that there are about the health, the safety, the economic, the climate impacts of methane and fracking, and why it's so imperative that we begin the transition to electrification. A big part of this that we keep referencing are the health impacts, and I want to name some of those for folks because we have found and studies have shown that burning methane indoors in a stove, furnace, it produces significant waste products like nitrogen dioxide, carbon monoxide, particulate matter, formaldehyde. And it's been shown that children who live in homes with gas stoves have a 42% higher chance of developing asthma symptoms. So this is really crucial. And, you know, we like to think of it as like, it's like lead paint. A while ago, people used to love lead paint because it had really bright colors. And then we learned that it was, of course, not, those bright colors were not worth the massive health impacts that it was having on people. And that's the direction that we're moving with methane gas in our homes and buildings.
That's an interesting analogy. I'm also thinking about when they took lead out of gasoline, which was a real hardship. I remember at the time I was driving a 1960 Volkswagen bus, and this is like in the late 70s, and there was no way that my bus was going to run on unleaded gas. So it was a major transition we had to go through. So let's talk about a little bit more about what we went through, both in removing paint, lead from paint and lead from gasoline, what it took and how you get over that pain.
Right. I mean, I think part of what we're doing with this report here is a big part of that. It's really demystifying the industry jargon and PR campaigns that are being fed to us. Millions and millions of dollars, these mailers that you started off reading. So we felt like this is our opportunity to really inform the public and inform our elected officials on why we need to do this. And this report also, the impetus of it came because folks in Multnomah County here, we were advocating to Multnomah County to help pass a policy that they released back in April called a green building policy. And it essentially limits or stops any new county building now has to be built fully electric. So any county-owned building, like a library, like the new big library in Gresham, which is what really started this policy, it cannot have fossil fuels hooked up to it, which was a really exciting first step in this process of municipalities like leading the way on how we transition away from gas. And it really is just a first step. We want to see this from happen for all buildings across the county and the city, not just county-owned buildings. And that's something that Dylan is working hard on, and Eugene as well, too.
I guess I would just mention, too, I think there's also a parallel with the campaign against tobacco and getting labels on cigarettes and other tobacco products. And, you know, like Deneen mentioned, there's a huge value in governments, all levels of government, kind of intervening to make sure that consumers are aware of the public health risks associated with the product. So in this case, labels would be a really, I think, huge step in the right direction, so that when someone bought a gas appliance, they were informed about the health risks that they were facing. And then also creating policies to protect the public in publicly owned buildings like Multnomah County is doing, and to ensure that we're not creating incentives and subsidies for the continued expansion of these products and of their market share. So, you know, there's many policies that we've seen, or many parallels rather, that we've seen where the government has, you know, identified that there's a product that's posing a hazard to public health, and of course, in this case, to our climate, and then stepped in, regulated that product, and put in place policies to encourage the use of other kind of alternative products, or to discourage the use of the product altogether. And I think that's absolutely what we need to see with gas, because, you know, when Northwest Natural writes in a letter, oh, in 20 years, we'll be 100% renewable, you know, we know it's not true. And at the end of the day, we know that Northwest Natural in 20 years either needs to completely change its business model and use those pipes for something besides shipping fossil fuels, or it probably needs to just go away.
Well, I'm thinking again about the idea of lead in gasoline, and also a lead in paint, and that one of the things that really shifted our attitudes towards those two items was that we began to understand just how dangerous lead was. Do you think that there's a way to draw parallels from the campaign that really educated the public about the dangers of lead to having a campaign now about the dangers of methane?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's why a massive part of the work ahead of us is public education and changing the narrative. This is, you know, years ago, people used to commonly refer to coal as clean coal in cases. And that's where we're at with quote unquote natural gas. There's a paradigm shift that we need to force in the way that people really see the energy that is all around us.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFT LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Deneen O'Rourke with 350 PDX and Dylan Plummer with the Sierra Club about the dire hazards of methane. And just a reminder that KBOO is in the midst of our fall pledge drive. You can help us reach our $55,000 fundraising goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Speaking of community power, let's talk a little bit about community-powered power. Because you mentioned that a little bit, Dylan, about the idea of distributive power, about having more local things. Because I keep going back to last February and being without electricity for 3 days. And it does seem like it's one of those things that would be really unnecessary if we had more local access and local control over the sources of our power.
I think that you know, that is definitely what we need to be striving towards right now, is greater community control, more investments in decentralized energy generation, whether that's solar arrays on households or community solar arrays, and of course, storage. So having large scale batteries that can be providing a backup in the case of large power outages for essential services, and in some cases, entire neighborhoods. And in Portland, there's already a really great model for this with the Portland Clean Energy Fund, and creating resources to empower members of the community to create these projects and to, you know, really start to build out that clean energy future and that climate resilient future that we desperately need. In the rest of Oregon, though, sadly, the kind of ability of municipalities to pass clean energy fund-esque policies was preempted. And so there's a real need for looking at alternate funding sources and investments so that we can really make sure that all communities have access to a renewable and resilient power supply that is community driven and community directed.
I'd love to just shout out here to the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign, which this past legislative session passed some pretty remarkable groundbreaking legislation. And the 100% clean energy for all bill that passed House Bill 2021 not only creates the fastest timeline in the country for a state to reach 100% renewable energy, it also does create a pot of money and funding for these community-based energy projects that communities can apply to for local energy projects.
Well, I want to throw out another issue that's come up in some other shows that I've done about battery storage, and that has to do with the evils of lithium mining. And we're experiencing that at the Nevada-Oregon border right now, where this lithium mining that's being proposed would go on Paiute land, as usual. Indigenous people are taking the brunt of that. And so I wonder what your thoughts are about figuring out ways to have adequate storage for electricity that isn't going to involve whole-scale mining that's going to largely affect communities of color and indigenous people.
I think that that's the million-dollar question right now is how do we create solutions for energy storage, for renewable energy, and how do we generate renewable energy in a way that's not going to disproportionately impact historically marginalized communities, indigenous communities, and, you know, thinking in an international lens, like what we saw in Bolivia, you know, where there was a coup d'etat that a lot of folks believe hinged around Bolivia's lithium resources. So how do we do this in a way that's not going to just impact folks domestically, but that's not going to impact folks internationally and just continue to expand the United States' legacy of imperialism? And, you know, there are some exciting potentials. Like I mentioned, you know, I'm very tentative about this because as with all new technologies, there's a lot that needs to be researched and a lot that we need to, you know, really look into before we start scaling. But green hydrogen, when not used directly in a gas pipeline, but instead used as a form of energy storage by taking renewable energy that's generated on a windy day or, you know, from offshore wind or a sunny day in a solar array and using the excess to create hydrogen with 100% renewable energy that can then be shelf stable to some length and then burned to create power on peak energy use days where maybe the current, you know, energy generation isn't enough to continue to power the grid. So that is, you know, something that folks are looking at. And of course, there's also, you know, some other opportunities there. But again, I think that the question is, how do we proceed in this transition and ensuring that it's a just one?
Well, the more that I read about the issues about storage, the more concerned and flummoxed I am. Another method that's been discussed has to do with pumped water storage. And there's, again, a big controversy out in the gorge about a pumped water storage project, which is on Yakima land and would have negative impacts on the Yakima. So even though these ideas might sound good, they have consequences. So I wonder, how do we vet this and how do we get past the point of sort of dreaming about having this kind of really permanent and very large-scale mass storage?
And I think that, you know, obviously this isn't a perfect answer, but I think that you know, listening to the leadership of frontline communities in these decisions and in these processes is going to be the most important thing that we can do to ensure that these impacts aren't, you know, going to be disproportionately affecting those communities that so often bear the brunt of environmental degradation or environmental impacts broadly.
Now, I also want to talk about how do we create a fully electric future, which has all the benefits and the niceties that we get from gas right now, because there are certain things about gas, like having gas heat, having an actual flame that burns is a lot warmer and a lot cozier than having an electrical coil that's getting hot. So are there ways to make electric technology feel more like actually like wood heat or gas heat?
I can't speak specifically to making electric technology feel more like a kind of natural flame, but I can say that the technology around electric appliances is moving at this really amazingly rapid pace. For example, heat pump heaters, which for a long time struggled to heat in really cold climates and weren't necessarily always the most efficient, they've come a very, very long way in just the past decade or so, and offer really great energy savings, very efficient heating, and they also offer cooling. And so, as we experience heat waves like we did this past summer, increasingly in the Pacific Northwest, it's going to be so critical that folks not only have heating, but they also have access to mechanical cooling. And so some of these electric appliances, while we might lose some of the luxury of the kind of feeling of the flame, natural heating, they do provide benefits, a myriad of benefits, including increased efficiency and, like I said, the addition of mechanical cooling with no additional cost, no need to buy an air conditioner unit for your home as well.
Right. And one of the biggest pluses of this, too, is lower cost. There are numerous studies that show that a fully electric new construction home can save around $130 to $500 a year versus a newly constructed home that's heated by gas.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about what it's like to have heat pump. I've been in a couple of houses that have heat pumps, and they were a little bit older. They were really noisy. They were not real attractive, but I've been hearing great things about heat pumps. So I just wonder, have either one of you been in a place that's actually heated by a heat pump or cooled by a heat pump?
I have, yeah. And the thing that I liked most about it was the convenience of it too, of being able to switch from heat to electric. I don't currently have one. This isn't a place I was renting. Yeah.
So I'm assuming that just like you have like vent, you have ducts and vents, and it'd be forced air heat, basically like what our gas heater is right now.
No. So heat pumps, they're really modular, which is another benefit, right? So they're like an insert on your wall, and you might have two or three throughout your home. And so one of the benefits you get from a heat pump is that it's like, unlike, forced air, air duct heating, you can choose which areas of your home to heat or cool at a certain time, so you're not wasting energy heating parts of your house that aren't currently occupied. And yeah, like Deneen said, there's just this huge convenience. You have a remote control, you walk into your living room and you turn on the heat pump at a certain temperature. They're very quiet now, they're energy efficient. And a recent study by RMI found that in Seattle, heat pumps are not only capable of maintaining comfortable and safe indoor air temperature during extreme heat, but they also cost $228 less per year to operate than a dual fuel cooling and heating system. And they reduce CO2 emissions by about 25% for the entire home operating with a heat pump rather than high capacity AC and furnace. So there's this massive, financials or economic saving, and there's also this carbon saving that comes from making a relatively easy switch from, what we might be more accustomed to, which is like air duct heating, to heat pumps. And like I mentioned earlier, the technology is just moving so rapidly that, in a couple of years, I'm sure there'll be miles and miles beyond the efficiency and efficacy of gas furnaces.
How do you feel the heat that comes out of a heat pump?
It like pumps it pumps air out of a just like a wall unit. So I guess it is forced air, but it's not like a duct system.
It sounds very attractive. It sounds like it would have a lot less cat hair in it in my house.
Yes. Yeah, and another thing with heat pumps that we've also been campaigning around is, you know, there's a big problem in Oregon with the Energy Trust of Oregon, where you can actually get a financial incentive to upgrade your gas furnace to a better gas furnace, but there aren't the same incentives to switch from a gas furnace to a heat pump. And so we've been trying to work with the Energy Trust of Oregon and get them to see that this would be a massive win to make heat pumps more financially accessible to people if we had better incentives for people to switch.
Let everybody know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Danine O'Rourke with 350 PDX and Dylan Plummer with the Sierra Club about the dire hazards of methane. So Dylan, you wanted to talk about what's going on in Eugene right now, where you're from?
Yeah, I think that Eugene is a great example not only of the kind of growing movement that we're seeing across the Pacific Northwest for electrification and for these really common sense climate policies at, you know, all levels of government, but it also provides a really clear illustration of the propaganda campaign that Northwest Natural and its ilk are waging against small city governments, against grassroots activists, and what have you. So in the Eugene, there's been a coalition of organizations, including the NAACP Springfield Eugene, Beyond Toxics, Springfield Eugene Tenants Association, and others, advocating for a mandate or an ordinance mandating that all new construction be all electric. So no new fossil fuels in new construction, as a starting point for our city to really get on track to meet our climate action plan goals and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in line with what scientists tell us is necessary. And for the past year, we've had an incredible campaign led by young climate activists, led by social and racial justice advocates, advocating for this transition. Yet at every step of the way, Northwest Natural has been spending thousands of dollars on lobbying, on advertising, on mailers. One mailer they sent actually advertised that burning gas in your home improved air quality. So not only are they spending money on propaganda, they're blatantly lying and misinforming the public about their product. And they're actively threatening our council with frivolous lawsuits, with a greater public relations campaign by hiring some PR firms locally. And it's just, I think, been so informative to see, you know, the lengths that Northwest Natural and, you know, many other gas companies around the region are replaying the same playbook, what they're willing to do to fight against policies being advocated for by, you know, youth, racial justice, housing justice advocates. And it really helps to kind of understand Northwest Natural, not as what they would like us to believe, you know, our friendly local neighborhood utility providing clean energy to Oregonians, but instead as, you know, another piece of this international fossil fuel industry apparatus that's willing to go to any lengths to preserve their share value for their investors in Wall Street, even if it means cooking our planet, you know, impacting our public health, and explicitly lying to the public about their product. And so we're really excited. We think that our council is ready to be the first in the state of Oregon to pass one of these policies. We've seen them pass. The 50th city in California just passed one last night. There's been policies passed in Seattle and other cities in Washington. And we're really excited. We think Eugene could be the first in Oregon. Yet nonetheless, just really, again, astounded by the lengths that Northwest Natural is willing to go to continue shipping and combusting fossil fuels for the profits of their shareholders on Wall Street.
Well, another piece of this puzzle is the upcoming debate about the proposed Oregon Climate Protection Program. And I guess there's going to be a hearing just in a few days on September 30th, which people might be interested in attending. And you might want to plug that at the end of the show. But one of the things that's really concerned me about the draft plan is that it excludes fossil fuel as it excludes natural gas as a fossil fuel and basically gives a free pass to Northwest Natural and any other gas providers in the state to get away without having to be part of this program of doing cap and trade and of actually limiting their carbon footprint. So what do we do about that? And how much involved has Northwest Natural been in making sure that they don't have to be part of the taxed and abused fossil fuel industry in Oregon?
Yeah, it's been disappointing to see the gas industry at the table in the writing of these rules. And, you know, like you said, this means that you know, six of the largest polluters in Oregon are fracked gas power plants, and under these rules, they would be they wouldn't have to apply. So it's imperative that people participate in these DEQ processes and testify and send in comments and make it clear that there is no place for fracked gas in anything that could be called a climate protection program.
So how do we go about making sure that doesn't happen and countering, again, Northwest Natural's incredible power of spin?
I think it's critical right now, and this is something that I think everyone needs to participate in, is revoking Northwest Natural's moral license. You know, they are a fossil fuel company that time and time again show up in these spaces to lobby against any kind of meaningful climate action, whether it's in Salem, whether it's, you know, on phone calls with Eugene city councilors. They are doing everything they can to stop any kind of regulation of the burning of fracked gas in the state. And it's critical that, you know, we as Oregonians say that enough is enough and do not allow for them to continue to have the influence and the seat at the table that they do currently. That we do not allow for politicians to call themselves climate leaders while accepting fracked gas dollars from Northwest Natural or from other gas utilities. That we do not allow, you know, progressive PR firms to take contracts working for these fossil fuel corporations. And that we educate, you know, ourselves and our communities about the multitude of impacts that are coming from, you know, these companies' business practices.
So how well do you think you're doing in getting that message across?
Well, through this process right now, it's imperative that people can submit comments until October 4th. And so we can include the link for people to submit comments on this program in your show notes. And also that public hearing that you mentioned on September 30th at 4 p.m., that will be another really important place for people to show up and testify and support others who are testifying to make sure that fracked gas doesn't get an exemption. And I think that, you know, the movement to stop the fossil fuel industry as a whole in this region has been incredibly successful. And a lot of that work has been in stopping major infrastructure projects, pipelines, export facilities. There are dozens and dozens of projects that have been stopped. And this is really like a new chapter in what it looks like to be fighting the fossil fuel industry in our region. And we're starting that new chapter with so much success on our backs and so much power as a movement. And the only option for us is to continue winning. And I believe that we will continue to do that.
So you're saying basically we're moving on from stopping bad projects to try to stop or to create a whole new set of rules and a whole ethos and a whole ecosystem that will not even allow these bad projects to rear their ugly heads. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Right. Right. We need to see that when a new building is built in our community and it's hooked up to gas and fossil fuels, that is building new fossil fuel infrastructure. That's part of our, when we say keep it in the ground and we say no more fossil fuels, its pipelines, its power plants, and its buildings. Buildings account for about 1/3 of Oregon's climate pollution. They're a massive source of pollution. And so we know what we need to do to solve that issue, and it's electrification.
I would just say, you know, the climate movement in the Pacific Northwest is done playing defense. And now, you know, we're turning towards the policies that are going to really shape that just transition, that clean energy future that we need. And the fossil fuel companies are scared. And every time I hear a Northwest Natural commercial on the radio or see one on TV or get a letter lying about, you know, how great natural gas is, I think that that's just another indicator of how successful we are and how frightened that these companies feel right now. Because, you know, as the saying goes, I don't remember how the saying goes, but something about laughing at you and then fighting you.
Well, I want to get back one more time to the Climate Protection Program hearing. So just give us a little bit more information about when it is, and hopefully you'll send me a link and we can put that on the Locus Focus website as well.
Right. Yes, it's on September 30th from 4 to 7 p.m. This is an official meeting with the Department of Environmental Quality, their Environmental Quality Commission. And yeah, there'll be a link for that in the show notes. And then there's still a comment period that will be open until October 4th at 4 p.m. where people can submit comments about this plan.
Well, the people I talked to a couple of weeks ago about that program were saying that even if the climate protection program does not really pass the fracked gas sniff test and allows all those power plants to be exempted, there's still more fights, there's still more proposals on the table. So what do you see if the climate protection program doesn't really meet your hopes? What are you going to do next?
Right. Well, I think what Dylan has been talking about in Eugene is incredibly exciting, and we're all cheering them on, and we're continuing to do similar advocacy at our county level in Multnomah County. And we're working to expand the resolution that they passed back in April of no new gas in county-owned buildings to include any new building that is built in Multnomah County should not be hooked up to fossil fuels. And this is just following what, as Dylan said last night, the 50th city in California has passed a ban like this. So it's high time for municipalities in Oregon to follow suit.
Well, Deneen and Dylan, it's great to talk with you. I hope we can talk again soon and continue this saga of how we electrify our communities and hopefully soon the rest of the world and move away from frack gas. So thanks for being on Locus Focus.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, Barbara. I'd also just love to add before we close that folks can read the report that we've been mentioning if they visit powerpastfrackedgas.org/resources. And we'll have that in the show notes too. And we really hope that you use this as a tool to combat greenwashing.
We've been talking with Deneen O'Rourke with 350 PDX and Dylan Plummer with the Sierra Club. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KIVU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KIVU Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm and listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KIVU staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KIVU in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us now, during our fall pledge drive, by becoming a member of KIVU or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community radio station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Dominic Della Sala about speaking truth to power in the realm of science. We'll go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Get your COVID shots. And remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
took a look at his license plate. It said, just ice. It's justice, just ice. Governed by greed and lust. Just the strong doing what they can. And the weak suffering what they must. Oh, and the caskets. And the oil spills. And sex sells everything. The office, the rapist in the pool.